Like the bedroom, Anya found the Sultan's adjoining bathroom large and luxuriously appointed, but not hopelessly gaudy or decadent, as she expected a South China Sea potentate's bathroom to be. She showered for a long time. It took time for the multiple jets of water, which she had turned to stinging heat and strength, to flush away the sensation of having her skin covered in blood. When she emerged from the shower stall, she found a fluffy white robe and fresh towels had been placed on the green marble counter by soft-footed servants. Wrapped in a sense of floating unreality, she toweled herself mostly dry, put on the robe, and wrapped her hair in another towel. She emerged to see that Weira's room had been completely cleaned. Sprays of fresh flowers, including lilacs, had been placed in niches on the wall, in planters on the floor, and on most horizontal surfaces. They did a startlingly effective job of masking the harsh sense of disinfectants, which in turn did a pretty fair job of masking other, even less congenial smells. The stained rugs were gone, the tile beneath cleaned up readily. The bedclothes were so fresh she could smell them. She suspected the very mattress beneath, huge as it was, had been replaced. With a little bit of express elevator sensation in her stomach, it occurred to her to suspect that somewhere in the great gleaming onion-domed pile of the palace, or the vaults beneath, was a storeroom stacked with replacement mattresses wrapped neatly in plastic for just such eventualities as this. Cleanup after failed assassination attempts. And, she supposed, those that succeeded as well. That was one thing that decisively linked the mightiest monarch to the most miserable beggar. When they fell, life went on. The major difference was the amount of energy other people put into pretending otherwise before getting on with it. At the big bed's foot sat Weira. He wore new pajama bottoms, these of pale orange silk. His hair, still unbound, hung to either side of his face like heavy, dark curtains. As she came into the bedroom, he raised his head and smiled at her. His smile had a haunted quality to it, as did his eyes. Anya got within 6 feet of him and stopped. She was unsure how to proceed. She felt cleansed, but extremely drained.
Thank you.
For what?
Saving my life. It was a very professional attack. The intruders were inside the grounds in force before anyone discovered them. They left teams to delay my bodyguards getting to me. Almost long enough.
She came and sat next to him on the bed. That seemed harmless enough. He certainly didn't draw away.
Why did they use swords?
The Langai Tingang. That translates as the longest tail feather of the hornbill. Very poetic, really. It's a type of Dayak Parang. You're familiar with the Dayak?
Borneo tribesfolk. Some of them tend to be pretty resistant to the modern world.
Anya could feel Weira's warmth. She smelled soap on clean, masculine skin, realized he'd showered as well. She felt honored he had let her use his personal facility while he went elsewhere, even if it was just one door down the hall. The odd courtly courtesy seemed so typical of him.
You're very knowledgeable, although I suppose it is your line of work, and resistant to the modern world is a nice way of putting it.
Well, being quick with a euphemism about native peoples is one of the skills we learn in anthropology if we don't want to be ostracized. Most times it's justified. Sometimes it goes too far. Were these men Dayaks then?
Oh no, sword of the faith. For some reason, that's the weapon they've adopted as their literal sword of the faith. They fight with swords as a point of honor, as do my own forces, as you've seen. In a strange way, I believe the assassins were honoring me. Despite my embrace of Western ways, measured though it is, I am apparently worthy of a most traditional death.
I'm surprised your guards didn't try to take any prisoners.
They did. The guards in your room. Neither in particularly good shape. The Sons of the Sword, as they call themselves, do not surrender. Nor do they talk. As I'm sure you realize, torture's no use for getting actual information. The mere threat works fine on the weak-willed, but Sword of the Faith weeds those out in ways you probably could imagine, but wouldn't care to, I think. For the others, torture can serve for punishment, to terrorize others, or to generate false testimony.
I know.
Also, I suspect my guards felt chagrined that they were so late to the scene, especially since they found their work being done for them by a foreign woman. A very beautiful one. with a crusader-style broadsword. Where did you get that, Anya?
What do you mean? I managed to wrestle one of the swords off the assassins who came to my room. I've practiced sword fighting a lot. It's one of the reasons I decided to become an archaeologist, even if my specialty did wind up being documents. And really...
I know what I saw.
Maybe I grabbed it off a wall. Events are a bit of a blur.
Anya, dear, there are no straight-bladed, cross-hilted swords in this palace. I may be a modernist and a moderate, but I am a Muslim. To us, the cross-hilted broadsword is the dominant symbol of a crusader aggression. And all this begs the question, where did the mysterious thing go?
Anya looked Wira in the eye. She noticed they had long lashes, beautiful eyes. She felt her cheeks grow warm and her breath grow short. Her skin took on a tingling sensation.
Does it really matter?
No. No, I suppose it doesn't.
Wira reached for Anya. He drew her to him with a hand on her shoulder. She turned to meet him.
Oh.
Their mouths joined in a kiss. It went on and on.
Oh.
When they broke away, Anya stood before him. He took her hand, kissed her palm.
I have to go, Anya. A helicopter waits to take me to my fleet, which is already on the way. I won't see you until I get back. You may stay here as long as you wish. You've the run of the palace, my dear.
Be careful.
Anya turned and rushed from the room, feeling a flood of emotions. Only 12 hours had passed when Anya slipped over the gunwales of the power junk she had chartered into a black Zodiac boat bobbing in the chop as a swollen red sun plopped into the dark Celebes Sea. The weather scans showed a new storm system spinning its deceptively slow way south of the Philippines, out of the wide Pacific. Anya didn't think it would reach them before morning. It would leave time, she hoped. She waved goodbye to the worried-looking Philippine captain and crew, whose dark faces lined the rail. Anya throttled up the outboard engine. Anya found it kind of sweet of them to worry about her, especially since there was nothing to connect her to their vessel. Some activity in accounts under names other than the one on her birth certificate had led to a pure cash transaction to hire a fast-powered craft out of the fishing town of Tawi-Tawi, off toward the end of the Philippines' long, narrow Sulu archipelago near Rimba Perak's neighbor, Sabah. She had looked for a vessel with captain and crew of the poor but honest class. Captain Delgado and his crew were a tough-looking bunch, to be sure, but nowhere on Earth did the sea coddle weaklings. The ocean was big and powerful and heedless, and would swallow you without a trace for the slightest lapse in caution or judgment, or just on general principles. The conclusion they'd come to was obvious from their whispered conversations. Who else but some kind of secret agent would hire them to transport her and an inflatable powerboat loaded with electronic gear to the middle of nowhere? And that's where she was. Squarely in nowhere's midsection. In the dark, the little junk, whose captain was reluctant to display running lights, quickly vanished behind her. Anya was left all alone with the warm, thick air pressing against her face, the smell of the salt sea and the petroleum engine, and an entire sky full of stars. Before setting out, she learned that the moon, in its half phase, wasn't supposed to rise in this part of the world until around 2 a.m., She guessed that would be the outside limit of the envelope in which Wira, bless his reckless heart, would make his move. Heaven knew what kind of radar or night vision equipment the obviously well-capitalized Eddie Cow-Cow had to equip his pirate fleet, or at least his flagship, the Sea Scorpion. But there was no point in the Rimba Perak Navy making things easy on the pirates by allowing the waning moon to illuminate them. Anya steered the boat, frequently checking her headings against the GPS navigator, and tried not to dwell on how completely foolhardy this whole thing was. She had brought an emergency kit, a shortwave radio, and some flares, in case she just got utterly lost. She knew if the storm caught her out here in the open sea, they'd do her no good. She didn't much fear totally missing her objective, even though one thing she didn't have out here on her ridiculously tiny and remarkably fragile-seeming boat was a means to track the transmitter she'd snuck into the crate with the coffin. After all, unless events veered wildly off course, Her target was going to make itself about as obvious as it was possible to be. It caught Anya by surprise when the night flamed up before her. Out of nowhere, the sky, a few points off her port bow, lit with a gigantic yellow flash. It was followed by two more in rapid succession. Then an orange fireball rolled into the sky, and all kinds of lights began flashing. Tracer rounds arced gracefully,